Saturday afternoon in Beirut, and we all have forgotten what the weekend is. So my talk is going to be structured in three parts. I'm not going to dwell much about the problems of the power sector in Lebanon. I'm sure everyone has heard about them over and over again. And I'm going to be focusing on moving forward from here. What risks we have to account for in the reforms of the power sector, and what major key factors we have to keep in mind for. Why cost-competitive electricity is very important for the economic recovery, and the role of decentralized energy models. And lastly, in the third part, I'm going to have a quick overview of the energy sphere in the pandemic and post-pandemic, and how Lebanon can and other developing countries can now benefit, what kind of opportunities arise from this. So to start, you all know that the power sector issues in Lebanon are not really technical or financial, despite the huge financial impact. They're mostly rooted in the political bickering and the governance structure. So we failed to reform the power sector in the past three decades post-war, mostly because the system in Lebanon is based on power sharing, which has blocked all kind or all attempts to reform. And we find ourselves almost three decades later with almost $40 billion in public debt because of the power sector. So the technical issues can be solved very easily. So, you know, Lebanon is actually the size of a neighborhood elsewhere. It would cost around $2.5 billion to turn the sector 180 degrees, and it would take around 2 years. But we've been in this for...
Do one more.
So where do we go from here? So now the reforms are going to tackle mostly the technical and financial issues. But it's very important to keep in mind five major factors and five major risks that are going to be very important. First, that the government has typically focused on having quick solutions rather than sustainable solutions. What that means is that the government is always focused on finding last minute solutions, and these last minute solutions are normally very costly. So we haven't been looking for cost efficient solutions. We haven't been looking for sustainable solutions. We just have been getting to the sense of urgency, which means we've been compromising on sustainability. Two, the government is unlikely to get citizens' buy-in, and I'm going to get back to this later. Three, the private sector and investors are now risk averse on Lebanon, and unless there is a financial solution, the power sector is going to struggle more. Four, neither the government nor the citizens with the current economic crisis can actually afford to foot the bill of the reforms. And five, all the contracts we're going to sign in the future are going to be signed in US dollars, whereas the collection is going to be in Lebanese local currency, which means that even if we do hike the tariff, we're still going to end up in a high gap. And I've been saying this from before the financial collapse. Sadly, the electricity policy papers haven't been focusing on the financial costs on what we do with this. Why is this is very important to keep in mind? When we're going to do the reforms, there are going to be key factors to mitigate these risks. First, the regulator, and why the regulator, we hear a lot about it, but why its role is important. I'm going to get back to this. The role of procurement and building citizens' trust, and why having cost reduction is also very important. So first on the role of the regulator. So in Lebanon, we've had the law 462 in the year 2002, that part of it entails on establishing an electricity regulatory authority. That was in 2002, that was never implemented. So now in 2021 and in the past few years, we've been hearing a lot on amending that law. And the Ministry of Energy has been wanting to actually amend this law and dilute the role of the regulator. What that means is that instead of having full mandates for the regulator, some of these mandates will be passed on to the minister. So the role of the regulator in having full license, a full mandate is very important, because the regulator first sends a sign and a strong signal that the government is actually keen on implementing reforms, that would be a signal not only for the citizens, but also for the private sector, because when the private sector also perceives non-existing or no absence, no will for reforms, the private sector is going to be more risk averse, and citizens as well are not going to actually have trust in the government. So the role of the regulator, and having a regulator that has full mandates but also credible, legitimate, of people who are qualified to sit on the role of the regulator, is very important. It will build trust of citizens and trust of the private sector. Citizens' trust is very important, and it's not because we all want more transparency and so, because at some point the government is going to request to try to hike the tariff, of course, and to cut down on non-technical losses. So that means that the citizen is going to be bound to pay more for the electricity and also for the entire energy sector and for the fuel. Unless we secure citizens' buy-in, they're not going to pay more. And citizens' buy-in is also deeply rooted in the social contract. So when citizens perceive that there's a high level of corruption, they're going to be more hesitant to actually pay more. And procurement is going to be very important. Typically, the utility should be doing the procurement. So far, most procurement has been in the Ministry of Energy, and there should be specific public procurement law that institutes should follow for the procurement. The procurement would ensure, when we have actual solid procurement framework, it would ensure that we have cost-effective solutions and equipment and machinery. And cost is very, very, very important. So now, you know, we hear a lot about subsidies have broken the power sector. But a large part of these subsidies are because we're actually generating very expensive electricity. And this expensive electricity is actually because first we're using fuel that nobody uses anymore, heavy fuel oil and diesel oil, which are very pollutant but also very expensive. And we have aging power plants. That's in addition to all the shortcomings we have in the power sector, non-technical losses as well, non-billing, non-collection, electricity theft. If we look into developing countries, even when there has been a tariff hike, mostly countries have been unable to actually recover the full cost of electricity, which means that there would be more expensive electricity, but also the debt would actually remain. So one of the key lessons from developing countries when they've tried to reform the power sector has been reducing the cost of electricity. This has a bigger role than tariff restructure in achieving some sort of cost recovery for the power sector. I think I've been trying to go fast. Okay, so these are the key things to look for. I think I may have gone a bit too fast. And these are going to be very important. So these are very important, not just because we want transparency. Transparency has direct impact on cost, and cost is very important. At all times, we're going to need the private sector, because securing investments into the power sector is also very tricky, and can also lessen in developing countries have been facing issues in attracting investments, even when there has been some sort of power sector reforms, because of the poor performance of the sector. So we need to keep looking for the regulator role and mandate, the procurement, ensuring trust of the citizens, and involving the private sector. Sorry, one second. So now I'm going to get to the second part of why decentralized generation matters. First, as I mentioned, the political interference in the power sector is a major factor in hindering reforms. So how do we go from this into actually ensuring political will? Mostly we see in developing countries where there has been some financial economic crisis, there would be some sort of political will for actually implementing power sector reforms. This is driven by the fact that governments would be unable to actually foot the bill of the power sector. So they're going to actually be more willing to implement reforms. But that doesn't mean that all reforms are going to be efficient reforms, sustainable, or even linear. So mostly, we cannot expect that if reforms have started, that they're going to be fast-tracked, that they're going to be linear, that we won't fall back into shortcomings. Sorry, just give me one second. And so we need to also look into ways and models to bypass this political bickering. And if we look into the central government, everything that has to go into central government has been creating political deadlock and bottlenecks. So decentralized energy models are very important in reducing the role of central government and also reducing bottlenecks and political interference. And another key thing in decentralized generation, when governments attempt to do reform, especially in hiking the tariff, there is a very straightforward approach that most developing countries actually adopt. And it's very simple. They'll go to hike the tariff on the commercial sector, on the large industries, and try to maintain the subsidies for the vulnerable population, agriculture sector, and also the small industries. We see that very obviously in Jordan as well, and the impact of that on Jordan, our neighbor country. And I see here we have a Jordanian, Natasha. So in Jordan, they did that in 2000. They started in 2012 to 2016. What that means is that we're going to have all this commercial sector and all these large industries and medium-sized industries, which are going to be less competitive because of the high electricity bill. So these sectors are going to look into alternatives. And what they normally do is to go into distributed rooftop solar energy or so. So they're going to have less reliance on the grid, which means also that utilities are going to hate that in the future, because electricity utilities actually make their largest share of their revenues comes from these big consumers. So I think that Lebanon will go de facto into this. When they hike the tariff, all these facilities are going to look into alternatives. And that's very important for the economy. So when we actually talk about the power sector, it's not only important to see how we're going to secure 24/7 electricity. We have to also consider electricity and energy security and affordable electricity. And that has been missing in the discussion in Lebanon. The economy is never going to actually recover well if we do not focus on affordable electricity. And that's very important also for our trade imbalance. So if we're going to actually have competitive businesses, these businesses would need to have affordable electricity. And that goes for the agriculture sector, for the commercial sector, tourism, businesses, industries. This is very important and should be a key part of the discussion. And this is where renewable energy plays a huge role. How much time did I take so far?
Take your time, it's okay.
So when we get to the part where we're going to have an electricity tariff hike, this de facto actually happens. And there should be first a distributed energy law in Lebanon that the parliament needs to adopt and encourage this kind of solution, and a financial mechanism that would also encourage the deployment of these mechanisms. And the financial mechanism should also focus on key performance indicators and benchmarks. So it doesn't make sense to have a loan that goes for energy, for large scale, for businesses, but also for small scale, decentralized rooftop solar energy. And then, let's take a 10-minute question, and then we go into the global outlook and that what that means for Lebanon.
Yeah, sure. If anyone has any questions, I sure have a few, but if anyone wants to go first, let me know. Go ahead. Go ahead, Tamu.
Okay, so now we have the company that is basically maintaining and operating the Zouk power plant and the Zahrani one. Their contract will end on Monday. And we also have a storm on Monday. And the command center is also destroyed after the Beirut port explosion. Now, if you're gonna have like an issue or basically, you know, the storms, like last two storms, we had blackouts for hours and for days too. So what's gonna happen? You know, what do you think is gonna happen? What are we heading to in the next weeks, maybe months or so?
I cannot speak on behalf of the government, of course. I cannot speculate what they're going to do with the contract. But I'm going to assume that they're going to find a way to extend them. Regarding the control center, that's a very important component of EGL. And let me just mention what this is for the others. So we have a control center, national control center, that controls all the feeders, substations on a national scale in Lebanon. That was located at EGL building, and that was damaged in the Beirut blast in this past August. This component was very important because it enabled EGL technical team to be able to monitor everywhere in Lebanon through their control screen. And now that we no longer have that, it means that they actually need to call each other, call the technicians in each region, and ask them what feeder is not working, if they have any kind of shortcomings. So it means in the past, if there was a storm, it was if there was some sort of troubleshooting anywhere, they would be able to locate it on the screen. Now they actually have to call a bunch of technicians, and we don't have many of them to actually go through the area and find where the issue is. So Omar, as you're imagining and as you're thinking about, we're going actually to probably have more blackouts because it just takes more time now to locate any kind of problem in the grid. So yeah, there's a high risk of troubleshoot, sadly. But that also reforming, having a new control center, we need an entire new control center, would be part of the reforms of the power sector. So we actually need the government to do something about it.
Dana had a question before I go over Paul's and Mohammed's.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks. I'm just wondering what the legal coverage is for the current decentralized projects that exist. So I hear about net metering, but I don't really understand what that means. And so what are the legal structures within which the current decentralized projects in Lebanon function?
So there's been a net metering policy since December 2010, which means if you have a renewable energy technology on your facility, it's like your house, you have an institute, industry or so, you can apply for a meter, bi-directional meter at EDL. What this meter would do is actually calculate how much electricity you're consuming from the grid, but also how much electricity you're giving to the grid when you have excess of power generation from your renewable energy system that you're not consuming on site. And so you only pay for the difference, and you're allowed to carry, if you have extra credit, you're allowed to carry it for the next months for a period of a year. So the policy is there on paper. In practice, if you're going to actually, you need to apply for this bi-directional meter from EDL, and then it gets lost in EDL. So actually receiving that meter has been in the past complicated and lengthy process, although there's a digital application on EDL website that's very straightforward. And now with the crisis, it means that we cannot actually afford probably to import them. So this also would need to fall in the reform structure. But we need a law that enables not only net metering, but also policy for power wheeling. For example, if you do have a piece of land, let's say in Akkar, but you have a facility in Beirut, so you can actually implement a solar system in your land in Akkar and bypass and actually just account for the electricity consumption in Beirut. And other systems like peer-to-peer electricity, if you do have a renewable energy system, you can actually sell to your neighbor and other things that would be, there are in a draft decentralized renewable energy law that the parliament needs to adopt.
Paul is asking, are we aware of a fund willing to finance private renewable projects for existing facilities in Lebanon?
So now funds are complicated because everything needs, Lebanon needs to have a financial plan first for anything in the power sector or the energy sector in general to work. But there is a discussion of such a mechanism that would probably happen in the Ministry of Environment, hopefully.
Mohammed is asking if smart metering can be essential part or can smart metering be an essential part of the solution to create energy efficient households, which is what you just touched on, along with law and policies, some kind of reverse engineering thinking?
So smart meters are are essential in reducing the non-technical losses, but that also needs to follow an entire policy and a solid policy, because that would also follow the social contract. So if you cannot actually install the smart meters, they're not going to actually be of any value. And for us to be able to implement these smart meters, we need the electricity utility to have authority on the ground, to have the buy-in of the citizens, and to actually, there should be more communication from the officials of the sector with the citizens on the plans and what they intend to do and why this are actually important.
And Joseph is asking, since we can't rely on the government, how viable is it for citizens on a local level to be self-sufficient, solar farms per town, etc.?
He's gonna get to this later. So
you can continue the discussion if you want as we...
I'm gonna tackle this and do it, and then I'll get back to
okay.
Global outlook and this. So we currently got to this point where we know that we might get to more electricity blackout. So we still do not have a plan, not only for the power sector, but also financial solution for the economic and financial crisis for the country. We don't have a government. We don't know when we're going to have a government and when anything is going to happen. And so we also don't know how much longer we're going to be able to import fuel, how much longer BDL is going to actually provide the foreign currency to actually import fuel. So a key thing that should happen is reducing the load on EDL, because every time EDL is generating electricity, it's losing so much money. We don't have enough foreign currency reserves for... I don't know why I'm losing my voice.
Corona.
I hope it's not COVID.
Yeah. We're losing you.
Hello.
We
need to reduce imports of fuel. And so we need to actually, and it's important for energy security, because we need to rely on domestic available natural resources. So now that we're here, there are different solutions that can be implemented. Solar farms, microgrids, and there's a primary critical role also for including generators. So we can actually implement hybrid solar farms that would be hybrid solar and diesel generators, considering that we also have so many diesel generators. And there are so many villages that have centralized diesel generators. So we can have centralized generators, connect them to solar farms, and actually feed in the households and other facilities. It would reduce the load on EDL. It would ensure that we do have some sort of functioning power, even if we're going to get to more severe power rationing. So I think, it's just my opinion, that we should be actually very active in implementing these models where it's applicable. And we need to actually come up with out-of-the-box solution to finance these mechanisms. And there could be some sort of financing mechanism that could be applied for such systems.
If you want to continue, or do you want me to take more questions?
Let me take that last question.
Okay. So let me just, how many power plants is enough for us? And when they say two or three, do they mean they will cut off the older ones, zoo, etc.?
So zoo should be removed, but the discussion of the two and three is not about removing zoo. So the actual policy paper in 2019 actually includes six power plants, including rehabilitating and having a new power plant in zoo. When we talk about the discussion of two or three, there should be actually, the policy should focus on ensuring cost-effective, the most competitive solution for Lebanon that would actually rely on whatever domestic natural resources we have. So we have more energy security, so we cut down on fuel imports, and that would actually be sort of environmentally friendly, because also our power plants are heavy pollutants, our diesel generators are also very polluting. So any kind of solution should actually have that and the financial impact. So we don't have a financial analysis. The policy paper doesn't include the investment cost. So all this talk about two or three should actually fall within an actual policy of how much we actually need. There has been a study for EDF, Electricité de France, recently. So it hasn't been published. It's only in a draft. But in the draft study, it actually shows that we only need Salata power plants if we're going to go for all thermal power generation. That means we're not going to include any kind of renewable energy from now until 2030. Someone also had a question.
Nicolas. Hello, Nicolas. Yes.
Hi, how are you, Jessica? How's it going? Very quick question on my end. You mentioned decentralized energy and, you know, microgrids and all of that. And that's certainly an option, but it is an expensive option, given the fact that, of course, you know, you're going to have to back up, if it's renewable energy, you're going to have to back that up with something that takes care of the intermittency, whether it's diesel generation like we currently have, or batteries, or whatever the case may be. And, you know, your levelized cost of electricity as a result of that ends up being relatively expensive. And your renewable resource may or may not be appropriate for certain parts, and so on and so on. So even though it could be an option in certain niche areas, I'm not sure you're going to solve the problem just by looking at that, although it certainly should be looked at. So my question is this for you. Leaving aside decentralized energy and starting with the assumption that, unfortunately, our government is completely incompetent, and you know, that's always going to be potentially an issue, at least in the near term. What do you think, in your opinion, can be done aside from decentralized energy to solve this problem when it comes to electricity in Lebanon? Is there anything, despite the government's incompetence, that can be done beyond decentralized energy that will, you know, maybe take a step in the right direction in terms of solving the electricity issue in Lebanon?
First, I want to clarify that decentralized renewable energy is not an actual solution for the entire power sector. Yeah. It's an intermediate solution that would decrease the load on the pressure and the load on EDL until we need to implement two power plants, thermal power plants. But I meant to say until we actually have, because we're in a political impasse as well.
Yeah,
and we need to have something. So that's a way. And there are going to be more and more industries and facilities that they're going to adopt decentralized solution. But it's not decentralized. It's not a long-term sustainable solution for the entire country. At all times, we still need to implement two thermal power plants, at least now. So if we actually tendered this a few months ago, a few years ago, we'd actually now not have this problem. But it's not necessarily a very expensive solution, because Even if we do couple it with batteries, it is still now very cost efficient. But what I was trying to say is that we need to have a solution that would take into account the financial impact, and what needs to focus on having the most cost competitive solution that relies on whatever natural resources we have. What we can do other than that, I honestly don't know. Everything needs a political will. The asset of decentralized and distributed energy is that it can be deployed easier without actually reaching a consensus for a political will to actually implement those reforms. But the power sector is eventually national, and there needs to be regulations, clear policies, and there should be an actual will to reform. So there's so many things that can be done on the individual level, on the local level, also in implementing more energy efficiency measures that would also reduce not only the load on EDL, but also would reduce electricity costs, and especially in the future when there would be a hike in tariff. But we cannot operate without any kind of government, without any kind of will. And honestly, my personal opinion is that if we did get to this and we cannot secure a political will to actually move forward, we're seriously with the worst politicians.
Thank you.
Thanks. So I don't know if you...
And let me add one more thing that we also talk about also have a key problem in Lebanon is that when we do have laws, they're actually not implemented. And we need consistent policy and laws that would be implemented. And there's a huge role for the parliament. The parliament's role is not only about issuing laws, but also ensuring that they're actually implemented. Okay, so should we move with the last part? And we take the last questions afterwards?
Yes, and then I'll have a few questions of my own towards the end. A bit of discussion. So yeah, unless you want to watch Barcelona or something.
It's actually my team, best one.
Hell yes, Visca Barça.
Okay, so let me get to the bit of the COVID impact on the energy industry globally. So the COVID has actually impacted energy demand and the demand for fossil fuels, because there's less aviation, less transport, less electricity consumption in so many places where the highest consuming electricity sector is not households. In the Middle East, the residential sector is the highest consuming of electricity. So we've seen, and you've noticed in the past few months, that there has been major reduction in the cost of oil per barrel. Moving forward, what that means, we might get to two scenarios. We might get into underinvestments in the oil industry, as many investors find that this industry is highly volatile, is less reliant, less sustainable, and they seek other investments. So we might get into a bit of underinvestment in the oil industry in probably end of 2022, 2023, which means that oil prices are going to also increase. And now we've witnessed that oil prices have actually a bit recovered. So oil normally also depends, prices of oil depend not only on the market, but also of the perception of where the market and where demand is going to be. So we might look into higher oil prices in end of 2022 and end of 2023. That would mean that while the oil industry and petroleum producing economies would be making more revenues, it might also mean that consumers who normally look for alternative technologies when prices of oil go up would actually seek some sort of renewable energy. So it's for green people like me, it just means it's good news because there are going to be more investments in renewable energy. The other thing is that with fossil fuels and also COVID impact on health, there's more focus on having health come first. What that means is that we're going to be more mindful about the impact of fossil fuels on the environment, on health, on air quality. And so we're witnessing more discussion on having health first. And that means a greener recovery and building better. So central banks are dropping some investments in fossil fuels, sovereign wealth fund, the big investors, even oil industries. You might also notice them. Now they all say we're not an oil company, the oil and international oil companies. They're now focused on saying we're energy companies. So they're also more focused on renewable energy, low carbon technologies, electric vehicles, and so on. With all that shift from investment in fossil fuel into low carbon technology, there's going to be a higher investment opportunities for developing countries and countries such as Lebanon to actually seek investments and receive investments for any kind of low carbon technology. So in the future, it would be easier to secure investment for something sustainable other than fossil fuels. And Lebanon should actually make the best of this opportunity. We also find that clean investment funds, a lot of this initiative now have open calls for projects and countries that are going to invest in low carbon technologies. So Lebanon should be actually seizing this opportunity, especially now that we're struggling to actually have any kind of investment. I thought there was energy problem question.
No, it became the chat has become too serious now. It's like the important issues on the side. Yeah.
So what we're looking for on the medium and long term is that it's easier to secure investments for sustainable projects. And so Lebanon should have a portfolio of sustainable projects, not only in terms of renewable energy, but also low carbon technologies. And these are cross-sectorial. So renewable energy also can feed into the agricultural sector, making it more cost efficient, especially in water irrigation, commercial industries. And it's very important for a country like Lebanon to focus on job creation. When we speak about large-scale energy projects, these are typically won by a handful of large-scale companies, but small-scale projects can be deployed by SMEs and small-scale energy companies, and they can create local employment. And here also, it's a question, actually. It's not something I want to say. It's like, why Lebanon still doesn't have any kind of special economic zones? And we can actually implement these zones and focus on providing renewable energy in these zones and create jobs for the local community. And that can be deployed in rural areas and create all these jobs and retain people in their lands. Hydropower. So now with hydropower, the good thing about hydropower is that it can feed the base load, so it's not intermittent like solar or wind, but we have less of this potential in Lebanon. I think we can still add some 300 megawatts.
Natasha is asking about the cost of the reform of the sector. What would this include, or where would this be allocated? Human resources, grid, equipment, thermal power plants?
That would include thermal power plants, renewable energy, investments in the grid, in the transmission network, in the distribution network, and into having smart meters. I just want to highlight that it would cost this much to actually reform the entire power sector. Lebanon in the past few years have been paying almost this cost every single year. So the average cost of the power sector fiscal deficit in the past decade has averaged $1.6 billion.
Cynthia is asking, how do you see the future of gas? Also the future of oil producing Gulf countries.
Okay, that's very complicated. So gas is considered as the bridge fuel for the future. So gas has a longer lifespan than oil. So we expect oil. So eventually nobody knows. We all just have speculations about when the oil industry is going to peak, but it's probably going to peak by the end of this decade. But oil, but gas is going to actually outlive oil, but so long, because gas is often considered as the greener fossil fuel. What does that mean for oil producing Gulf countries? That means different things for different countries. So Saudi Arabia sits on the throne of oil, whereas Qatar sits on the throne of gas. But also, while these countries have high plans for energy diversification and economic diversification, we're witnessing now that they also have high plans to try to sell and ramp up their oil production as much as they can and export as much oil and as much as they can before it actually peaks, the demand peaks. And in the future, so the winners are going to be the fossil fuel producers who can produce at the lowest cost and the lowest emissions, which are actually also in Gulf countries. So they're trying to make the oil industry and the petroleum industry last as much as possible and to be as sustainable as possible.
Mike is asking, and I have a question that relates also to what Mike is asking, but I'll try to fuse them all together. So is there any country that is in a similar position as us, or has been, or in terms of, you know, their power sector, where it was or where it is or where it will be?
So I asked this question to a colleague of mine who has who's much more experienced and who recently retired from the power sector. And I asked him, so which country is similar to Lebanon? And he told me about the country, and then he was like, no, actually they solved that in the 1990s. So in terms of the power sector has so many issues in all countries, especially in developing countries. So if we look into dissect each factor, we're going to see many similarities. So the regulator underperforms in most of the developing countries. There are non-technical losses, and they're mostly the government overestimates how fast they can cut down losses almost everywhere. It's very hard to actually achieve cost recovery of power, of electricity, in most of these developing countries. But getting to actually this impasse of reforms for three decades is actually something.
And
there's also Lebanon and Iraq are very closely tied to this, although Iraq does have more reforms than Lebanon, definitely.
Which is where my question in relation to Mike's talk a few weeks ago comes in. Because his talk was about, he's trying to make sense of this political stalemate, right? And in terms of game theory and why each political party are making things worse. A very stupid question, naive question on my end, but why? I genuinely don't understand why can they even agree on something that is as simple as electricity? Like, where is the stalemate there when it comes? Is it, in what sense is it politically a problem? Is it because they need more money, or they cannot divide the shares, or is it like, what exactly are they disagreeing on when it comes to reforms?
That's $1 million question.
Right? It's like, seriously, it's like,
So normally when you have bottlenecks that have lasted this long, it means one thing, is that all the parties sitting on the table have some sort of vested interest in maintaining the status quo, which is actually the case in Lebanon. So you see, it's not one party involved. It's so many people in power, and it's not one specific part of the sector. So if we look into the entire value chain, there are so many opportunities and vested interests for these people and for these parties across the entire value chain. And that goes through the fuel industry, the imports. Of course, we have a $2 billion generator in formal industry. We have the procurement and we have the sectarian procurement in Lebanon, because you cannot get anything moving unless it actually has to account for all the facts. Otherwise, it's not going to move forward. So we also witness that it's very evident in the FSRU talk. So Lebanon to be able to switch to natural gas, because natural gas is going to be less expensive and less polluting for Lebanon. And that's been in talks for the past at least a decade. And we haven't done that in a decade. And then if we look into the tenders for to have a natural gas, we need to have infrastructure and we need to have a way to actually provide, import that natural gas in Lebanon. So the government has decided to have a floating storage and regasification unit, which means we're going to have the storage unit where we get liquefied natural gas and we turn it back through shipments, and then we turn it back into gas. And the plan was to have one in 2010. It was tendered in 2013. And in 2018, that turned into three units, just to account for the different sects in Lebanon. So,
yeah. Wouldn't in this case, and the question becomes, in this case, isn't the decentralized solution the best one in that sense?
So again, it's not, no, because, one second. So, and when we talk about decentralized solutions, so it's easy to have decentralized renewable energy because these feed in one facility or one neighborhood or one village. But when we're actually having thermal or large scale, this kind of national scale units, they actually feed the entire nation. So if we're going, and I hear that sometimes in the discussion of thermal power plants. So if you're having a power plant, if you have it in Zouk, it doesn't mean it's generating power to the people in Zouk. It might be just generating power and it's just being given in Bekaa, because these are electricities that's actually transmitted through a high voltage. So it's not unlike the renewable energy, small scale distributed energy, it's not feeding your institute or your neighborhood.
One question.
I think we just had two.
Someone is asking if renewable or energies work in Lebanon, for starters.
Yeah, of course. So we have different resources in Lebanon. We're actually gifted because we have at least 300 sunny days. I think this year is actually more. We have sun, we have wind. There's a wind atlas for Lebanon that's accessible on UNDP Lebanon portal that shows the wind speed. So for wind to be economically viable, it needs to have a wind speed. The location needs to have a wind speed of at least 7 meters per second. And there are different places in Lebanon where we have that, especially in Akkad. And we also have different kind of technologies, but they vary in terms of cost. And so one thing about renewable energy cost is that the more we deploy renewable energy, the less cost is going to be, because there would be more companies doing that, there would be more competition, and there would be more access to the technology. Concerning the wind energy, so there is actually a contract for 3 in Lebanon for wind power. And Ahou Akkar is one of the companies. So there was 3 companies that have signed power purchase agreements with the government. So the government, these companies have some sort of BOO model where they implement the wind farms for 25 years. And then they sell electricity throughout this period to the government, and the government purchases electricity from these companies. That was signed in 2018. These are not yet implemented, and now they're facing the hurdles of the financial crisis and other issues, but Ahou Akkar is one of the 3 companies that have won this. And if these farms were implemented, they would have added some 220 megawatt of wind in Akkar. there have been many plans for renewable energy, and so many have stalled. And also renewable energy follows all the political complications as well, and there is of Lebanon. So everything in the power sector has so many bottlenecks, sadly.
Maintenance, would the maintenance costs or aren't they big enough to actually make petrol-based facilities more efficient?
You didn't get the question. Does that mean the power plant?
I think.
In terms of wind. So all that, the government had signed power purchase agreements, which means that it is private companies, that private developers that would implement the wind farms and would do the operation maintenance throughout that period, and then just sell electricity to the government. So the government would just be purchasing electricity per kilowatt hour throughout this entire period. It's like BOT, except for in the case of renewable energy, because renewable energy technology actually would peak within that 25 years period. So the government, so the developer would commission it at the end, decommission it at the end of the contract. So it's build, own, operate throughout 25 years.
Natasha is asking 6.1 gigawatts potential for wind alone. Could the country move forward with the large scale contracts, or should all PPAs be frozen and audited?
So that 6.1 is theoretical. We would have actually some 1.5 gigawatt that would be implemented. So that 6.1 is theoretical without accounting for other constraints other than the wind speed, because we also need to account for land availability and others. So Lebanon only has signed these three power PPAs for renewable energy, and they actually haven't been implemented yet. How they move forward with this, I'm not sure, because they haven't reached financial close. So normally developers would reach financial close before implementing anything, and they haven't yet. And in the financial crisis, it's unclear where this needs to go. Also, we have to be very mindful that probably until we actually have a solid framework, solid financial solution first, solid policy for the power sector, solid procurement framework and regulations, it's a lot of solid things that we need to have. We're not going to get cost competitive projects. So the return on investment, all these developers were going to aim for higher return of investment just to mitigate all the different risks.
Khalid is asking about perhaps creating some sort of Lebanon Energy Trust, which is raised by private investors to support microgrids. This will inject cash flow into the economy, create jobs, etc. It could also leverage green loans from international financial bodies or companies like Siemens and Total, etc. Can generate profit from selling the excess back to the grid. It has potential to cover 20%, blah, blah, blah. What do you think?
Okay, so there are different issues with that. Designing a solution is very simple, and Lebanon can easily also tap into diaspora funds. So making this happen in theory is very simple. However, it all goes down to who's going to manage it and how it's going to be implemented, because also there are so many different risk factors that need to be accounted for, and there should be de-risking factors for them, including selling to actually injecting into the grid, because first the grid is weak and needs investment. So we also have a whole bunch of risks to de-risk, including the political instability, the economic instability, who's going to get, how they're going to get paid back, because if they're going to pledge money, all the private sector is going, would actually need to make sure that the money they're pledging is actually going to go back to them. They're going actually to be repaid. So the economic risks, the at some point when there is a financial solution, there should be an indexing of the power project, of the currency for all power project, at which currency they're going to get paid, at which conversion, sorry, exchange rate of the currency they're going to get paid. Because all this and the grid risk is very important and it's normally accounted for everywhere. They need to have you need to have substations. If the government is not providing that, are they going to cover that? Who's going to go into a whole bunch of permits? Because also we don't have a one-stop shop where all private developers can just go and get all the licenses. So you need to account for all of this. And so this is it's very important to have a government buy-in first on any kind of solution and government will to move forward. Because the government is very important, has an important role in actually de-risking any kind of measures.
Paul's question is, they proposed, and I'm reading them for those who will watch us later. We have proposed to
Can I just add one thing before we get to this?
Sure. Yeah.
And this is why actually having a decentralized renewable energy law is very important. Because then instead of having to de-risk this on a national level, you can have, if you're going to implement some sort of system and you're going to finance it for a village level, you can have some sort of deal with the municipality, with the citizens, and just sell them electricity without having to go through all the bottlenecks on the national level. That's very important for renewable energy, and these kind of funds would work in this kind of mechanism.
Paul is saying that they have proposed to have industrial zones created and completely disconnected from the grid with its own power supply. The design would require some connectivity to the main grid. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's the way to move forward, because first, industrial zones are a critical factor in the economic recovery. So we cannot look into the power sector as a standalone component. The power sector impacts everything in the economy. And having an actual economic recovery plan that includes industrial zones is important. They can connect to the grid, but it could be also designed to account for less energy consumption from the grid. So it could be connected, like we can have solar, and it could have multiple sources. So we can have a system of renewable energy that could be connected to the grid or standalone, but it could also be hybrid grid, solar, diesel. So it could be multiple source, and it depends on the design, on having a technical design that would rely less on the main national utility, if that's what we can aim for. So the design is actually simple. It just goes back to actually having a vision of where the country needs to go.
Tamo is asking, what's your input on importing Iraq's oil? Seems like this is the main solution. This is one. And what would you say also in relation to, in the meantime, as we might be seeking other solutions, what will happen in relation to subsidies, costs? How the hell are we going to be managing? Because it seems that we're going to be effed soon.
There's no substitute to actually having a solid, comprehensive policy and a plan for the sector. There's no substitute to this. What we've been doing in the past decades, it's actually getting to the point where we have now an urgency and we need to procure any kind of solution. So we need a fast kind of temporary solution. And then we get stuck into the temporary solutions being the only permanent thing in the power sector. So we need a comprehensive plan. What's happening now is like what's always been happening. We wait until the last minute. The government needs to have sustainable solution and a sustainable plan. So we cannot go on forever on having a transition kind of temporary solution. The fuel from Iraq actually doesn't work in Lebanon. So I'm not sure where they're going to actually refine it. And there's something they stated that actually worries me a lot, that they're going to exchange a fuel in Iraq through a private company that's going to take that fuel from heavy fuel oil from the Iraqi government and then substitute it with something that would actually work with the turbines in Lebanon. And then we get the swap. So I can see how transparent that is. In general, if we're going to get, we already use bad fuel, and if we're going to get worse fuel than the bad fuel we're using, it's also comes at a cost, not only in terms of the fuel we're paying for, but also in terms of maintenance cost. And that's also very critical, because when you're using bad fuel on our turbines and in power, on our thermal power plants, it means that our operation and maintenance cost is going to also rise up.
And that's something Mike also shared the other day with a paper that was investigating pollution and the quality of the fuel that is being imported sometimes is not up to standards, and they have to falsify records and stuff like that. I don't know, but yeah, so it's bad. And is putting solar panels on roofs that provide self-sufficient building and neighborhood while relieving the grid from load a utopic idea, or can the funding for the project be done by a multinational entity like World Bank? Like, is this a utopia or not, simply put?
No, it's not. We can actually do that. It goes down to the design of the solar system. So you can design a solar system to just be to feed your facility for a certain period of time, to actually displace your diesel generator mostly, or to actually be completely standalone and just no longer reliant on the grid. So you can have solar panels, but depending on your aim from this solar system would be the what kind of design you'd go for, what kind of capacity, and then would also if it's installed on the roof, then we also need to account how much roof availability you have, unshaded space. But also would factor in what kind of equipment you'd need. So if you're implementing a solar system that would be connected to EDL, but also to your diesel generator, then you no longer need batteries. If you're just going to bypass the entire utilities, then you need battery to store, if you're going to have solar system, to store the electricity produced from the solar system for when the sun is not shining and you actually have load. So there are different things we can achieve technically. It goes down to what purpose we want. And yes, there could be different financing mechanisms, and there could be different funds that could be put together through multilateral funding, through development agencies, and also you can tap into climate finance funds.
Before I get to Joseph's question, Mike is saying it sounds like we most likely are moving to a permanent diesel motor ishtirak system with even less EDL power and no sustainable alternative, which is what I want to comment on. Why do you think people don't have a problem in paying for these? But then when it comes to electricity, actual electricity, it seems that how much do they collect eventually, 40% of what they need?
So it's not just a matter. So there is a misconception about that as well, because people think that everyone is just deciding not to pay. But we also only have like 67% percentage of electricity that's actually billed. So there are actually facilities that never receive an electricity bill. So EDL needs to up also the billing, not only the collection. So we have collection a bit less than 60%, but we also have billing of some 67%. And I disagree with, I tend to disagree with the scenario that we're going to go more into just generators.
But you're too optimistic. Of course, we've already established that.
Well, most people normally tend to find me depressing, so actually that's good news. But so there's a scenario where EDL can decide to do power rationing. That would have more severe power rationing, because we already have power rationing, but that would have serious political implications as well. And then our key issue is now that we don't have enough hard currency to import fuel, and that's going to impact not only EDL but also the generator suppliers. So, and they're going to hike the tariff as well for the consumers, which means that the way I look at it is that people would have to look into alternatives and rely more into solar, and this kind of financing mechanism should have been in place months ago. But yeah, that could be my optimistic outlook.
Joseph is asking, yes, at a local level, it's good, or it seems like it's a starting point. But moving forward, where do we start? Besides, I think maybe the framework or a comprehensive plan, like some concretely speaking, where might it start? Sure. Like assuming everything has been put in place, right? And we have a policy and everything is agreed on, etc. Where do we go from there?
Is that for decentralized or for the entire sector?
No, entire sector. Like it's decentralization is good for a few maybe years, but then eventually.
So it's not. So you cannot end the entire supply gap with just distributed. It would just, like as I said before, it would reduce the load on EDL, and every time EDL is producing electricity, it's losing money. But there's no substitute, and I've said that a few times. I'm sorry, I have to repeat it. There's no substitute to actually have a functioning government that has a will to reform. You cannot actually achieve cost-competitive solutions, sustainable solutions, without having a solid, comprehensive policy that accounts for how the power sector is going to evolve, not only next year, but also for the many years to come. What kind of vision we have for the power sector? What's going to happen for EDL, because we need to restructure EDL as well. What do we do with electricity utility? And that should be also clear to the private investors, because when an investor comes to invest in a country, they need to have a clear vision, a solid comprehensive policy, and actual regulations. And regulations are not only laws that are there on paper, there needs to be actual laws that are actually implemented. And for this to happen, we need a functioning government and a functioning parliament, because also the parliament is there just to issue laws, but they're not ensuring that these laws are implemented. There's no substitute for a functioning state.
And as such, what will you do with the generators syndicate/mafia? Wolverine is asking.
And to get back, I will answer this with the question before and how come they actually collect. And I've written about this before. I've published something on making reforms work where I think I've tackled this in this piece. So collection and the electricity provision from the states also follows the social contract with the state and also the perception of citizens from the state, which is why I highlighted earlier when I started talking about building citizens' trust. When citizens tend to perceive that the government is actually corrupt or that the state is actually not looking for their best interest, they tend to be hesitant to pay for anything that comes from the state. They feel like they're entitled to have something and the government is not providing it, so they're going to have electricity. And also another factor and why it's very important, we cannot have a policy paper that doesn't account for the current status. Currently, we have a $2 billion industry that's now the generator industry. It needs to be accounted for when we make plans for the sector. Is there a way to integrate this in distribution or in other kind of subsector? And this need to be accounted for. And there's an important factor in the generators that is typically left behind. And the generators actually have authority on cutting your power. So if you do not pay for your generator, neighborhood generator, they're going to cut your electricity. But we don't have that with EDL, because EDL doesn't have authority. We have distribution service providers who do not have the authority to actually cut any kind of power from non-paying consumers. And there's an important also factor is that social cohesion. So normally your neighborhood generator, the owner of your neighborhood generator is someone who's going to live somewhere near you. So there's also some probably personal relationship, or you might actually know that person. So this is important. And when we consider moving forward on how we can integrate the assets of this and actually achieving better collection rates and better billing.
Interesting. And approximately how much a system like this, I'm assuming the solar, would cost for a 200 meter house? Any idea?
So you cannot say for actually it's better if, so a 200 meter house would depend, the consumption would depend on what they actually have in the house. And I'm not sure about how the costs are now with the crisis, but you could actually implement some 20 amperes solar system in around $12,000.
And given how expensive generators are, Natasha is asking, how cost efficient is a system like with battery storage? Where, what's a system like? I'm not sure what that is. But yeah.
So Natasha, who actually is not Lebanese and doesn't live here, knows about the Jabula system. I'm impressed. Jabula is in the Bekaa, where there was an investor who decided to implement a solar system that goes through three different towns in the Bekaa. And it's kind of prepaid electricity system. It's one of the models that would be enabled more and more if we do have better laws that actually permit distributed energy. So that system, through that system, they actually installed a centralized solar system connected to the generator with small battery storage that feeds into different houses. So they went to the houses and asked them if they're interested to actually have to connect to the system. And then they installed some meter for prepaid electricity. So you go and decide to purchase electricity, like you just recharge your phone for a prepaid car. And they're going to give you that into your meter in your house. And that's actually working, except for the financial crisis has also increased the burden on this, because the collection and the devaluing currency actually makes it harder. So this is why I also keep repeating that we need to have a financial solution, and we need to have indexing of the exchange currency for everything that's power.
I think, and I always just maybe one last question on my end, or if anyone also has one last question to wrap it up. There's always talk about, you know, just removing subsidies, and there is no one solution. You have to make it gradual, but we're not in a situation whereby we can make it gradual because we're running out of reserves, etc. We're in quite the pickle. So how would you convince, I don't know, how would you convince people to pay more for electricity if we need to take out subsidies, or what will happen? Like, how are we going to be managing that in the very short term?
One, we're not going to take out all subsidies. So the vulnerable population keeps increasing in an economic crisis, and the vulnerable population we have to maintain the subsidies for in any kind of scenarios in the near future. So that should be one factor. The second factor is that you cannot hike the tariff if you do not drastically cut down on your non-technical losses. Imagine I hike your tariff and you're a paying customer, but your neighbor doesn't pay any electricity. What are you going to do?
Yeah,
you're going to go into social unrest. So you need to show authority. And this is why I'm going to sadly keep repeating myself. Citizens' trust is not important in terms of transparency. It's important in terms of being able to implement whatever policy you're going to actually come up with. If I do not trust in your, if I do not have trust in your plan, I'm not going to buy into your plan. And I'm going to make it very much harder or pretty much impossible for you to implement the plan. And citizens' buy-in cannot happen in the current situation where we keep having a widening gap in trust between the government and citizens. And there should be clear communication plans and dissemination of any kind of plan and what the government is actually doing. And it cannot just be at the cost of the citizens. So there should be also some compromise from the government side as well and from the politician side as well. And
it seems like Mike's prophecy this is more likely to be the case, perhaps. Like what Mike said seems to be more plausible. We'll just rely on our generator around here.
And then you're going to implement solar system, which is going to make me happy. but also, as I also said before, it's also important to cut down on your electricity costs. No matter how much you're going to increase the tariff, if you're not going to reduce the cost of production and the cost, overall cost of recovery of electricity in terms of technical and non-technical losses, you're still going to end up with high financial losses.
Would what Rabia is saying work? Power Generation Coalition to advocate and pressure policymakers?
I think it's important because there should be lobby groups for the different sectors, not only for power and waste. We're at the stage where we need policymakers to move forward. There is no way individuals alone can actually transform the sector. And I keep saying there is no actually, you cannot decide to just bypass the state. We need to have fun. I do believe in having an empowered state and empowering institutions. And there should be, I think that's important. I'm not sure how, so I don't also want to put high expectations because we got to the point more than a year ago where we actually defaulted. No, it's like 11 months ago where we defaulted, Lebanon defaulted on its payment, and there's been no action in the past 11 years. So I'm a bit hesitant into making assumptions that these policymakers are willing to move forward, but there should be a way to actually for them to at least start some sort of reforms. And if any kind of lobbying efforts or coalition would actually help move forward, not only with policymakers, but also rally public citizens and have more public engagement as well.
And Paul's last question, what do you think of electric cars becoming part of the storage system of the country, assuming a wide use in the coming future? If Jessica's optimistic, Paul, I think, is like on a whole other level of optimistic. It's, yeah.
No, it's not. We're actually, where Lebanon is now could be an opportunity if we decide to seize this opportunity. We actually need to establish foundations in so many different sectors. We don't have reliable public transport. We can do so much if there's a way, if there's a will, sorry. When there's a will, there's a way. There's so much that could be done with electric vehicles. So we're not at the stage to worry about what we're going to do with our intermittent renewable energy because we don't have intermittent renewable energy shares that's so large. But it's a problem I'd love to have. There's so much we can do. We're not in a situation where solutions are not there. There are lots of solutions. We're in a situation where action is not there. And now we need to act. We need a government that's willing to act. We need policymakers that are willing to act. And we need to have citizens engage in whatever vision we have for the future of Lebanon.
Which is where...
And it's also, we can tap into so much financial resources for this. So we have a non-functioning transport sector. The fuel in the future is going to be more expensive. There's so much we can do. We can tap into so many different fundings if we do have not only transition in the power sector, but vision for energy transition. And energy transition includes not only the power sector and not only a few solar farms and wind farms here and there, but an inclusive, comprehensive strategy that covers the transport, the power sector, that covers what kind of sector we want for the future, not just for the few months to come.
Maybe part also of the problem is people or many who are involved cannot even agree on the private/public sector involvement. So for example, if you want to bring in private companies from, let's say Siemens or something, many people would be skeptical of this. So they would want it to be all nationalized or all national projects, etc. So is that also a problem?
Not having citizens' buy-in is a problem, wherever you look at it. And if the citizens are going to perceive anything as corrupt, it's regardless of what company does that. And there have been cases in other developing countries where citizens have perceived the project to just be highly corrupt. It might not necessarily be the case. It could just be a perception of corruption, and then they will stop any kind of project. So you need to build this trust. now the trust is not only not there, it's keeps on, there's a huge gap and it keeps on widening. So as long as the citizens do not have trust in the government, whatever company you're going to get, whatever investor you're going to get, they're not going to buy in. So you need to have trust with the citizens, and you cannot get this trust except through engaging highly credible and qualified people who show that they have a will to reform and they have a way to actually implement these reforms. Having policies or papers or plans is actually very cheap in Lebanon, because we need implementation and we need action and we need communication and citizens' engagement.
Well, maybe then the starting point would be to do just that.
It's easy.
but to gain the trust, to actually show political will and the will to action, which is also very, very difficult, perhaps. Is that Dawn? Is it about new people or new governance system? He's peddling his federalism here. It's a trap. I don't suggest you answer that question. but seriously, yeah, system of governance, maybe.
So the problem is the power sector are not technical, as I said earlier, and they're not financial. These are very easy to solve. They're deeply rooted in the governance structure of the political system in Lebanon that's built around power sharing and making sure that everyone has a piece of the pie, sadly. And I'm not going to get into...
No, but see, this is the thing between what Mike talked about when it comes to the game theory part and how each parties are trying to secure whatever is they deem is rational versus Iyad's federalism. And then we have on the side Paul's federalism, and then we have a debate. Well, maybe we need to start...
And I'm pro-decentralization.
Exactly. Re-examining the governance system to see where we're headed. Okay, Paul, you'll get your... debate soon, hopefully. But anyway, so I think this is more than enough for today. Decentralization is more federal. Yeah, well, it's just another word for federalism, perhaps, because
no, it's not.
But decentralized government.
I don't want to get into this debate now.
Yeah,
but
yeah, not that. Oh, yeah, we'll discuss that. We'll discuss that sometime in the future. Soon, hopefully. Well, for me, in the administrative sense. But thank you very much, Jessica, for this. Very helpful, at least for
thanks
me.
Thanks for everyone who attended. You know, it's Saturday evening, and everyone is locked down.
And tomorrow is Valentine, but everyone is locked down as well, so...
almost everyone.
thank you very much, and... I'll be uploading the talk shortly to YouTube, and we'll share. So thanks again, everyone, for joining in. Hope you enjoyed. Thanks.
Bye.
Ciao.